Proudly providing an alternative to commercial radio since 1999. CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, NHK Japan, Radio Havana Cuba, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We will begin with France 24. On their end-of-the-year programs, most international radio stations give a brief summary of the state of the environment. Here is what France 24 reported from World Weather Attribution, which is an organization which quantifies global climate changes. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza continued through the year-end, with Israel saying they were responses to daily rocket launches from Hamas, which they say has many new recruits. The political upheaval in South Korea over the president and his successor continues, with citizens manning the streets to express their views of the events. France 24.
This lake in Sicily, once described as an eternal spring, all but dried up for the first time on record this year, due to a lethal mix of hot weather and low rains. In India, residents lived through their longest ever heatwave, with 24 consecutive days above 40 degrees. And almost everywhere on Earth, people experienced 41 additional days of dangerous heat.
The poorest, least developed countries on the planet are the places that are experiencing even higher numbers. So places like Grenada, Trinidad and Tobago, Kiribati are experiencing 150 or more days just this year that are dangerous levels of heat that we can attribute directly to climate change.
World Weather Attribution released analysis of 2024 on Friday. They say shows how dangerous life has already become under human-induced warming. Ocean temperatures are rising and more water is evaporating, which increases the risk of torrential rain, as seen in the deadly floods in Valencia in autumn. Warming sea surfaces also accelerate the force of winds when they make landfall, which some scientists say can make cyclones even more powerful, such as the recent one that ravaged Mayotte. And an increase in drought and wildfires led to huge biodiversity loss.
We need to move away from fossil fuels much faster and completely if we want to avoid ever more extreme events that also will reach the limits of what societies are able to adapt to, and not get distracted by discussions of whether it's too late to do this. It's not.
In Gaza, medics say at least 6 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike at the Hamas-run Interior Ministry headquarters in Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip. That comes as over 20 were killed on New Year's Day as new Israeli airstrikes hit a number of locations in Gaza, including a camp sheltering displaced families in the south. Several others were killed in a residential area in Jabalia, a suburb of Gaza City. Meanwhile, the Israeli defense minister has threatened more strikes on Gaza if Hamas does not stop firing rockets at Israel. And we're going to talk more about this now with our Jerusalem correspondent, Noga Tarnopolsky, who joins me. Noga, what more did Israel Katz have to say, and what can we read into his comments?
Well, the Israeli army has just now acknowledged that it struck what it calls a Hamas headquarters or command center in a government building. That's the Interior Ministry strike that you just mentioned, in which apparently 6 people were killed. And on New Year's Day yesterday, the Israeli army even issued photographs of the Hamas police chief who was killed, I think, with a deputy in the humanitarian zone, in the Israeli-designated humanitarian zone, in which 10 people, a sum total of 10 people apparently were killed in that strike. It is true that the Israeli defense minister is threatening to keep hitting Gaza if Hamas keeps shooting rockets or missiles into Israel, which has become, again, a daily event. But that should be our main point of focus. The Israeli government has refused throughout this war, now 15 months of war, to designate or to accept any alternative governance structure for Gaza. And as a result, it has failed in one of its primary war aims, which is to defeat Hamas as an administrative and military force. In fact, in a statistic that was just released today, leaked to an Israeli journalist, the Israeli army estimates that there are about 20 to 23,000 Hamas fighters fighting against the Israeli forces in Gaza right now. What that means is that Hamas is able to recruit fighters at a higher rate than the Israeli army is able to eliminate those fighters. And this really is a direct result of the Israeli government's refusal to appoint or designate any alternative governing body for the Gaza Strip. It has given Hamas the opportunity to regroup, to rebuild itself, and to even return to the situation we're in now, where it's again shooting rockets inside Israel daily.
The standoff in Seoul, South Korea's impeached president still refuses to turn himself in to face sedition investigations. Yoon's supporters are outside his residence. He's vowing to fight to the end. Well, Yoon declared martial law earlier in December. This was overturned just a day later by lawmakers. His legal term is warning police officers attempting to detain him that they could face arrest by his presidential security service or even by civilians.
The Corruption Investigation Office for high-ranking officials is trying to arrest President Yoon Suk-yeol, but he's saying he won't accept being arrested. We are here today to express our wish that he quickly accepts his arrest, faces detention, and steps down as soon as possible to bring an end to the current political turmoil.
Every law enforcement in this country has been unlawful. The country is in a state of civil war and anarchy. President Yoon needs to return so that he can normalize the country.
Those reports and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. First, an update on a warrant issued for the ex-president of South Korea, which he rejects as invalid. The Washington Post reported that Nippon Steel will allow the U.S. government to veto on any potential cuts in steel production in the U.S. if the sale of U.S. steel goes through. Pipelines through Ukraine are no longer carrying gas to the remaining European countries. United Nations Secretary General Guterres delivered a year-end presentation on climate breakdown. NHK Japan.
The head of South Korea's anti-corruption agency says he plans to detain impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol before the warrant to do so expires on January 6th. A joint investigation team obtained the warrant on Tuesday to detain Yoon over his declaration of martial law. The investigators have accused him of orchestrating an insurrection. Oh Dong-un is chief of the Corruption Investigation Office for high-ranking officials, also known as the CIO. He told reporters on Wednesday that the agency will execute the warrant, but he cannot announce the date. Oh was asked about possible clashes with the Presidential Security Service. He said he can respond to such a confrontation by filing a case against the service for obstructing public order and other charges. He also said the CIO sent a document warning the Security Service against trying to block execution of the warrant on Tuesday. The warrant is the first against an incumbent South Korean president. Yoon's legal team has applied for a provisional injunction, saying the warrant is illegal and invalid and that the CIO has no right to investigate the president. The Washington Post says Nippon Steel is offering the U.S. government a veto on any potential cuts to U.S. Steel's production capacity. The Japanese firm is trying to complete its planned purchase of the U.S. producer. The Post said on Tuesday that Nippon Steel proposed a 10-year guarantee not to cut output at any of U.S. Steel's mills without federal government approval. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States had been examining the security risks of an acquisition by the company. After the panel failed to reach a consensus, it opted to have President Joe Biden decide whether to allow the deal. The committee had expressed concern that the purchase could decrease steel production in the U.S. But the Post cites a source saying that Nippon Steel may need to invest billions of dollars to maintain production ability in the U.S. in addition to its existing commitments. The paper quotes government officials saying that President Biden might approve the takeover on the condition that American jobs are preserved. But it also reports them saying that administration officials are mulling an approach that leaves the final decision to President-elect Donald Trump's incoming administration.
Now, pipelines through Ukraine are no longer carrying Russian natural gas to Europe. Russian energy giant Gazprom stopped the flow on New Year's Day after Kyiv refused to renew a pre-war agreement. Not even the Russia invasion in 2022 had interrupted the gas supply. State-affiliated Gazprom issued a statement on Wednesday saying it had lost the technical and legal possibility of sending gas across Ukraine. On the same day, Ukraine also announced that it had stopped the transport of Russian gas. Kyiv made good on its vow to choke off a source of revenue for Moscow by declining to renew the transit agreement. Russian media downplayed the move, quoting an expert who suggested increasing gas flows through Turkey and Bulgaria could partially offset the Ukrainian cutoff. But Reuters news agency reported that importers will have to pay higher fees for alternative routes.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has expressed a strong sense of crisis over what he called climate breakdown. Guterres urged the world to act now in a New Year video message released Monday. Guterres started the message by saying hope has been hard to find, citing wars, social inequalities and divisions. On the climate issue, he called on all nations to do something to stop the situation, which he says is happening in real time.
We must exit this road to ruin, and we have no time to lose. In 2025, countries must put the world on a safer path by dramatically slashing emissions and supporting the transition to a renewable future.
Guterres' message comes as the World Meteorological Organization warned that 2024 is set to be the warmest year on record. But concerns about global warming are likely to rise next year when the U.S. will have a new president. Donald Trump is expected to once again pull out of the 2015 Paris Agreement on climate change.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp as well as most podcast sites. All of the times they announce are for Pacific time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to Radio Havana, Cuba. A brief survey of climate upheavals in Latin America. The last year saw leftist election victories in Mexico, Uruguay, and Venezuela, and an attack on the Mexican embassy in Ecuador. There was an attempted coup in Bolivia. The right-wing government in Argentina accused Venezuela of kidnapping intelligence agents. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Environmental catastrophe also characterized this year. Bolivia, Chile, and Brazil mobilized forces, equipment, and financial assistance to fight forest fires. For more than 120 days until October, the government of President Luis Arce deployed operations by the armed forces and specialized personnel in an unprecedented joint operation to fight forest fires. In Brazil, the government did the same to extinguish flames concentrated in the Amazon, and then in May, Earth marked financial aid to help rebuild homes and businesses lost to the extensive flooding, which caused dozens of deaths. Forest fires advanced dangerously in February in regions of central Chile, a disaster described by President Gabriel Boric as the greatest tragedy in the South American country since the earthquake of 2020. The worst Dana of the century, also known as the cold drop, devastated southern Spain in November, particularly in the Valencian community, with rainfall of 2,000 to 400 millimeters in 24 hours. The storm left massive floods and caused more than 220 deaths. King Felipe VI of Spain and Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez were both subjected to insults by an angry crowd in Paiporta, a municipality hard hit by the heavy rains. In the opinion of the neighbors, the authorities abandoned them to their fate and failed to prevent the catastrophe. President Nicolás Maduro, political leader Claudia Sheinbaum, and Frente Amplio leader Yamandú Orsi won in the elections held in Venezuela, Mexico, and Uruguay, respectively. In Venezuela, President Nicolás Maduro won the July 28 elections, leading extreme right-wing leaders to order a wave of violence, which was controlled by law enforcement agencies. The extreme right, with the support of Latin American, U.S., and European governments, proclaimed its candidate, Edmundo González, protege of the ultra-conservative leader, María Corina Machado, as the supposed president-elect. In Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, a scientist and environmental expert, won the elections in June, the first woman to hold the presidency in more than 200 years of independence in Mexico. The left won Uruguay's elections on November 25, and Yamandú Orsi, candidate for the Frente Amplio, will become the new president after focusing his campaign on social justice. Violence in Ecuador also characterized 2024. Violence was exercised in Ecuador even against the Mexican embassy on April 5th in order to arrest former Vice President Jorge Glass, who had requested political asylum. Mexico broke diplomatic relations with Ecuador. The then Mexican Foreign Minister, Alicia Bárcenas, alleged the flagrant violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations and denounced the injuries suffered by her country's personnel in Ecuador. Conservative President Daniel Noboa implemented a state of emergency during the year in response to frequent murders attributed to organized crime and drug trafficking. The former head of the Bolivian army, Juan José Zúñiga, led an attempted coup d'état in Bolivia, which was opposed by the government, the rest of the armed forces, and the population. President Luis Arce directly confronted the ringleader and said that investigations showed that Zúñiga had accomplices, including civilians and other military personnel. More than 20 uniformed officers and civilians were detained as part of the investigations, including the three top former commanders of the armed forces. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Ivan Gil has described the statements made by the Argentina Security Minister Patricia Bullrich as bravado. In a message published on his Telegram channel, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister asserted that Bullrich now writes bluster against Venezuela. Bullrich disqualified the work of the Attorney General of Venezuela, Tarek William Saab, this Friday in relation to the case of the gendarme Nahuel Gallo. Bullrich declared that Gallo is a victim of political kidnapping and issued insults against the Venezuelan authorities. The Venezuelan Public Ministry highlights that Gallo, an intelligence agent of the Argentine government, intended to carry out an extraction operation to smuggle six members of the organization Venta Venezuela across the border in mid-December, while currently at the Argentine embassy in Caracas.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific time. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this program, like listeners in Redway and Ukiah, California, as well as Northumberland in the UK did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. Or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this program going. Please join the fun. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please, they need your support as well. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. German claims of election interference have increased against Elon Musk for his support of the far-right political party known as the AfD, or Alternative for Germany. In Gaza, over a million people are facing winter without enough food or adequate protection from the cold and rain. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
U.S. billionaire Elon Musk has riled politicians here in Germany by voicing his support for the far-right Alternative for Germany party ahead of parliamentary elections in February. In an opinion piece published in the conservative Welt am Sonntag newspaper, Musk called the AfD the last spark of hope for this country. Comments that governing politicians and opposition leaders alike are calling election interference. It's fueling a debate in Germany about free speech in the media. The opinion editor of Die Welt resigned after the opinion piece was published. More on this, we can speak now with our chief international editor, Richard Walker. Richard, why is a billionaire Trump supporter in the U.S. publishing an endorsement for the election here in Germany?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question, isn't it? And, of course, there are sort of two sides of it. I mean, why is Elon Musk getting involved in German politics? But also, why is he getting involved in politics at all? And, of course, that really began in the United States. And I was in the U.S. in the last couple of months of the election campaign there. I actually went to the Donald Trump rally where Musk, for the very first time, took to the stage with Donald Trump. And you remember the photographs of him kind of jumping for joy on the stage there. And you could really feel that he was psyched up by that, that he was really feeding off the crowd. And the crowd absolutely loved him. I mean, this was somebody who almost overshadowed Donald Trump at his own event. But, yeah, people have been talking in the U.S. but also hear about what is motivating that. Is there a business reason why he's doing that? And in the U.S., you can see business reasons why he would be wanting to get close with the Trump administration in terms of, you know, some of Musk's business very heavily dependent on government contracts, for instance, doing a lot of business with American space agencies, wanting to influence American regulation. But if you transpose that onto Europe, and it's not just in Germany, but also in the U.K. that you've seen Elon Musk getting politically involved now. The AfD are not going to form the next German government, that is for sure. And Nigel Farage, who Musk has been supporting in the UK, is also very far away from that potential goal. So it does raise the question of really whether this is ideological. And we see Musk supporting what he sees as a sort of version of Trumpism in Europe, whether it be in the United Kingdom with the Reform Party of Nigel Farage or the Alternative for Germany. Here in Germany, which he represents in his op-ed as a party that is kind of, you know, good common sense, sort of old school, sort of nationalist values, and where he tries to brush off a lot of the criticism that the party faces for its extremist tendencies.
I mean, this raises the question, Richard, you know, how well does Musk know the AfD party? I mean, parts of it are classified by German security authorities as right-wing extremists.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we can say pretty much for sure about Elon Musk is that he would not care about German intelligence services and their classification of the AfD. He would reject that. I think it's safe to say as exactly the kind of establishment control that is something that he says that he really wants to oppose. But I think what's quite interesting is that he, in supporting the AfD so vocally here, certainly gone beyond Donald Trump himself, and wider Trump world. So Donald Trump has certainly been associated with Nigel Farage, who I just mentioned there in the United Kingdom. But Trump world is a bit wary about the AFD. And I think I can say that from experience also speaking to people in Washington, D.C. They see the AFD as something that is potentially a bit of a no-go area. And I think that's not so much always to do with their policies, but more with the tendency of some members of the AFD to downplay Nazi history. And of course, that is something that would not necessarily go down well in the United States. So I think one thing that's going to be really interesting to watch is whether Elon Musk remains an outlier in supporting the AFD or if other parts of Trump world kind of follow him in this direction. The AFD itself has been celebrating this big time, but all the other parties are crowding in and criticizing this, that's for sure. I mean, I think the biggest challenge here is for the mainstream conservatives, the center-right CDU-CSU party. Friedrich Merz is running for chancellor for that party, going into the elections very soon. He said, "I can't recall another comparable case of election interference in a friendly country in the history of Western democracy," which might sound slightly overblown, but there's a lot of fear of where this goes from here.
The Hamas-run health ministry says 6 infants have died from the cold in Gaza as they face the second winter of war there. Food, shelter, and heating capacity are all in short supply. According to the UN, almost 1 million people will have to endure the winter without adequate protection from the elements.
Winter winds and rainwater are battering Gaza's sprawling tent camps. The tents serve as temporary shelter, but a continuous mass displacement crisis spanning over a year has rendered the majority of them no longer fit for use.
Due to the rain yesterday, water gathered over the worn-out tents and broke the wood, and the water went down on those who were sleeping. And we got up at 3 a.m. to try and gather what was left of the tent.
Like Abu Ahmed, 9 out of 10 Palestinians in Gaza are currently displaced, according to UN estimates. Displaced parents say they don't know how to protect their children from the cold. Doctors in the Strip say at least 7 people have died of exposure and cold, including 6 infants and a nurse. Yahya al-Batran was the father of twin boys less than a month old. He woke up to devastating news.
My wife checked his feet and found them like ice cubes. Then I checked the other child and found him cold. I ran to the hospital with the child, but as soon as I arrived, they told me he had died.
The twin brothers died. Ali passed a day after Juma.
I fled with my children to protect them from the bombing so that they would die here from hunger and cold.
The UN has warned that new tents and supplies are urgently needed to help Palestinians forced out of their homes survive the winter.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites. One of my goals in producing the show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from spinal injury, I am staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.